Shalom Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the prophet Ezekiel. This is the 2022 edition of the class, and this is session 41. And session 41 begins in chapter 43 and verse 1. So let's review quickly where we were last session, bring us up to speed regarding the class. Last session, we were actually measuring the temple itself. We pulled back the roof, and we saw that the walls of the temple were 6 cubits in size on the north, on the west, and on the south sides. Now, that'd be 10.5 or 10.25 feet approximately at the base, because these walls narrowed as they ascended. Now, we also were informed that there were side chambers along three sides of the temple, the south side, the north side, and the west side. The construction of the side chambers was emphasized. Each side chamber had a notch cut in the wall of the temple for its beams, the beams that supported the floor of the side chamber. Each notch was 1 cubit in depth. So we see the three stories here. The first story, therefore, had a width of 4 cubits, or 7 feet wide. The second story was 5 cubits, or 8.75 feet wide. And the third story was 6 cubits, or 10.5 feet wide. This was the construction of the side chambers. There was also some sort of a ladder or stairway, a situation that could bring you up from the first floor to the second floor to the third floor. Nobody knows exactly how it worked, how it was constructed, other than it was mentioned. We also noted that the temple was situated on a high platform that was about 10.5 feet, 6 cubits, higher than the inner courtyard. The platform also extended away from the temple itself by 5 cubits, or 8.75 feet. And that was a walkway, therefore, that would allow you to get to the doors, the two doors, one in the north and one in the south, that provided access to the side chambers. We also noted that the temple had other chambers, other outbuildings surrounding it, on the north, south, and west side, with a 20-cubit separation between the temple and these other buildings, these other chambers. Now, to the west, a building was highlighted. You can see on our slide here, the temple's on the east, and then we're looking toward the west. Now, the purpose for this building was not stated, but its size was stated. It was 70 cubits wide and 90 cubits long. Inside the temple itself, inside the holy place, we were told that the walls were covered with a decorative wood covering, veneering over all the walls, and that wood was decorated with alternating palm trees and cherubs. So the entire interior of the temple must have looked quite impressive with a nice warm wood color. Now, the cherubs had two faces. One was the face of a man, and on the other side was the face of a lion, similar to exactly what Ezekiel had seen in chapter 1 when he saw the divine chariot. Now, at the far end of the holy place, there was an opening for entrance into the Holy of Holies, and standing before that opening was the altar of incense, the altar of incense being 3 cubits high and 2 cubits wide. Then we moved into chapter 42. In chapter 41, Ezekiel and the angel were measuring the temple itself. But now as we move in chapter 42, that job is completed, and Ezekiel is taken out through the inner north gate to the northwest corner of the temple, and there he describes the two outbuildings on the west side of the temple complex. He begins by talking about a northern walkway. That's because the chambers of this northwest building opened to the north, but there was a mirror building to the south, and so there must have been a southern walkway as well. Now, the only drawing, the only illustration I have is of this southern building, southwest building, and the walkway that we're talking about was probably this walkway right here, mirrored on the north as well. We also noted that the southern and northern buildings stepped back as they ascended. The second floor stepped back from the first floor, and the third floor stepped back from the second floor. Well, now Ezekiel's measuring of the temple, the interior of the temple, is finished. And so the angel brings him around to the eastern outer gate. And this is the gate he entered through when he started his tour of the temple. And then the angel takes him around the outside of the holy domain and measured it. And we find that the holy domain was 1 mile square, 1 mile northwest and 1 mile east and, 1 mile north and south and 1 mile east and west. Now, that makes it quite a bit larger than the current Temple Mount. The current Temple Mount is only 1,464 feet long and 946 feet wide. So it can easily fit into the corner of the Messianic Temple's holy domain. So this is worship center is quite a bit bigger than the current temple and Temple Mount that we have today. And we also measured the size of the temple compound proper. And when we added up all the measurements, we found that it was 875 feet square or 500 cubits square, which is the same size as the 500 cubit platform that Solomon originally made. Remember, Solomon made that platform and he plopped the temple down in the middle of it on the high, I should say on the highest point of Mount Moriah there. But the temple only took up a small portion of that platform. Well, the Millennial Temple would have covered the entire platform had it been in existence. All right, that brings us now to the next material, the new material. And I'd like to review incident in chapters 8 through 11. Back in chapters 8 through 11, Ezekiel discussed the departure of the Shekinah glory from the temple, from the city. So let's give a quick review of the departure of the Shekinah glory. We'll start with a definition. What is the Shekinah glory? The Shekinah glory is the visible manifestation of God's presence, often, I should say, in the form of a cloud, a light, a fire, etc. One of those forms is Yeshua. Yeshua is the Shekinah, the Shekinah glory, in human form. Now, the Shekinah appeared over the Ark of the Covenant between the cherubim in the tabernacle and in the Solomonic temple as well. And we learn about this in Exodus 25, 21 through 22. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give you. There I will meet with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony. And I will speak to you about all that I give you in commandment for the sons of Israel. Well, when Ezekiel first saw the Shekinah glory, the divine chariot, he was by the river Chebar, and he was quite amazed by it. Here, I love this drawing because there's the artist that's put in Ezekiel, tiny little Ezekiel down there. But as Ezekiel looked up through the expanse above his head, he saw a figure that looked somewhat like a man sitting on a throne, but totally enveloped in the Shekinah glory, totally enveloped in the Shekinah glory. He also tells us that he noted, this is in chapters 8 through 11, he noted that the divine chariot was sitting to the north of the temple compound, and then that it moved to the south side of the temple. At that time, the Shekinah glory that was also in the Holy of Holies moved from the Holy of Holies down to the door of the temple, the first step in the departure of the Holy of Holies. Next, the Shekinah glory moved from the door of the temple and mounted his place on the throne of the divine chariot. Second point of departure. Then the divine chariot with the Shekinah glory, with the divine person, left the temple and hovered over the eastern gate. Third stage of departure. And here we'll repeat that. Here the Shekinah glory is on the southern side of the temple, and now the Shekinah glory moves over to the eastern gate. It would be called the Susa gate in those days. And we'll back off a little bit. From this point, the Shekinah glory then reluctantly hovered over the Mount of Olives. I think it's at the fourth stage of the departure. And finally, Israel is not repenting. Israel is not turning to the Lord. And so finally, the Shekinah glory ascends from the Mount of Olives into the presence of God once again. And so now the city is totally open to destruction by the Babylonians. There's no more protection for the nation, for the city, or for the temple, because God has departed and allowed his people, his city, and his temple to face judgment. Well, this brings us now to the text of chapter 43. And so we'll pick it up in chapter 43 and verse 1. Then he led me to the gate facing toward the west. Now this would be the outer eastern gate. Now Ezekiel is brought there in 42:15, but now he's brought there again because he and the temple circled the temple compound in chapter 42 verses 16 through 19 as they measured the holy domain. So Ezekiel's been taken on a trip around the holy domain, and now he's brought back to the outer eastern gate once again. And so here's Ezekiel waiting at the outer eastern gate, and now he observes the Shekinah in verse 2. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. So the sound of the coming of the divine chariot is like the sound of many waters, like the overwhelming rumbling sound of the ocean, like when you're at the Pacific Ocean and the waves are stirred up from bad weather and are constantly crashing against the beach. That's that constant rumbling sound. And we learn that that came from the cherubim as they raised their wings and moved. And then he also notes that the earth shone with the glory. Everything is brightly illuminated by the Shekinah glory. And the point is, the Shekinah, the Shekinah glory, is returning to Israel from the same direction that it had earlier departed. When the Shekinah glory returns, it will return to Israel from the direction to which it had earlier departed. Now, the departure is explained and emphasized in Ezekiel 10:19. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them, and they stood still at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house. And the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them. So here the divine chariot rises from its place to the south of the temple and goes over to the east gate. And again, the emphasis here, this is the east gate. It's going to leave in an eastward direction. Then we come to chapter 11, verse 23. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood over the mountain, which is what? East of the city. So there's a strong emphasis on the direction to which the Shekinah glory departed the temple. Now, what is the purpose of the Shekinah glory returning to the temple, returning to the millennial temple in this case? Well, the purpose is to authenticate the millennial temple. The Shekinah glory authenticated the tabernacle, for example, in Exodus 40, verses 34 and 35. Then the cloud, that's the Shekinah, covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So it's a glory cloud, it's a tent of meeting, it's the tabernacle. You see those synonymous terms being used here. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And the whole idea is repeated again. But this authenticates the tabernacle. This is God's authorized place where he will show himself, he will show his omnipresence in a specific location, dwelling with the people of Israel. This also was the temple was also authenticated in 1 Kings 8. It happened that when the priests came from the holy place, the temple has just been made, Solomonic temple has just been constructed, and the cloud filled the house of the Lord. So there it is. There's that glory cloud again. And so the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. That's the Solomonic temple. That's also discussed in 2 Chronicles 5 and 2 Chronicles 7. Now, the Herodian temple, the very next temple, second temple, remember the second temple was first constructed by Zerubbabel and then expanded and finally totally rebuilt by Herod the Great. And Yeshua also authenticated this temple as well, the Herodian temple. That's because he was a form of the Shekinah. And so he authenticated this temple as the dwelling place of God. So let's take a look at this. First of all, Yeshua was a form of the Shekinah, John 1:14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory. Glory is the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. So now the glory of that God has is unveiled in flesh. The Word is enveloped in flesh, is veiled in the human body. So when did John realize and see the glory of God? Well, he saw that at the Transfiguration, Matthew 17:2. And he was transfigured, that's Yeshua, was transfigured before them. That's the disciples that were up on the mountain with him. And his face shone like the sun, and his garments became white as light. So God allows the Shekinah glory, which was veiled by Yeshua's body and by his clothes, to penetrate through the body and through the clothes so they can see Yeshua in his unveiled state. So now he authenticates that he's a form of the Shekinah glory. So now he authenticates the temple. In Luke 2:49, he's about 13 years old here, one of his early trips to the temple. And he said to them, "Why is it that you were looking for me?" Talking to his mother and a guardian, Joseph. Did you not know that I had to be where? In my Father's house. So the young Messiah knows who his father is, and he knows that this is his father's house. So he's authenticating the Herodian temple. Then later on in his life, when he's about in his 30s, he enters the temple again, and this time he made a scourge of cords, and he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. This is the cleansing of the temple. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling doves, he said, "Take these things away. Stop making what? My Father's house a place of business." So he authenticated the Herodian temple with these two statements. All right, let's go on to verse 3. And what is Ezekiel's response to this vision of the Shekinah glory? "And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city, and the visions which were like the vision which I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell to my face." Well, the visions were the same visions he saw back in chapter 1, chapter 3, and chapter 10 of Ezekiel, the same vision he saw by the river Chebar. And his response, he falls on his face. He immediately pays homage in the presence of God when he sees that divine chariot once again. And again, there he is. There's small, tiny little Ezekiel, tiny little human being falling flat on his face before the immense glory of God. In verse 4, we come to the entrance into the temple. "And the glory of the Lord came into the house by way of the gate facing toward the east." So he comes in through the outer eastern gate. Now, the glory of the Lord departed through the outer eastern gate, and now the glory of the Lord returns through the outer eastern gate. And so there's Ezekiel by the outer eastern gate, and he sees the glory go through the eastern outer gate, through the eastern inner gate, and to the temple building itself. Now here's an illustration of the east gate from the inside, from the outer court. Ezekiel was on the other side of that gate. But if you then he sees the Shekinah glory coming. He sees the divine chariot and the Shekinah glory approaching from the east. We're looking east now. And now the Shekinah glory comes through the gate into the outer court, and the whole earth is illuminated with the glory of God, with the glory of God. Now, this gate that we're talking about is not the modern eastern gate that some people claim it to be. This is Herod's temple platform as it is today, and this is the eastern gate or the golden gate, and you can visit it today. I've been there a couple times. And some people think that this is the gate that Yeshua will re-enter the temple compound through. But that is not the case at all. This is Islamic architecture, Muslim architecture that was built, I think about 1,200, 1,300 years ago. And when the Muslims built these walls, they knew of the position, the rabbinic position, that the Messiah would come through the eastern gate, through the golden gate. So what did they do? They didn't want to encourage the coming of the Jewish Messiah. So they planted a graveyard in front of the golden gate. And you can see all the graves that are there today. And so that area is defiled by corpse uncleanness, according to the Mosaic law. And not only that they blocked up the gate with stones so that nobody could get through it. This is their defiance to the God of Israel and defiance to the Jews and defiance to the Messiah. But not to worry. This gate has nothing to do with the return of the Shekinah glory in the millennial temple. This gate won't be in existence then. We're in a totally different situation. We're on the top of Millennial Mount Zion with the Millennial Temple. And so don't worry about this gate. This gate has nothing to do with the return of Yeshua. All right. Now let's take a look as we move into verse 5 at the prophetic transport. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. So Ezekiel is here in the outside of the temple. And Ezekiel is lifted up by the Spirit and brought over the outer wall, the inner wall. He's now in the inner court, brought into the inner court. In the second part of the verse, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. So here is Ezekiel sitting in Ezekiel's temple, and the glory of the Lord now fills the temple, fills everything. Quite amazing, huh? And here's an illustration of the Shekinah glory filling the temple. Everything is illuminated by His glory. So the Shekinah glory is now in the temple, but eventually the Shekinah glory will probably be localized in the Holy of Holies, in the Holy of Holies during the millennial kingdom. And now with the Shekinah glory back in the temple, we have a message from the Shekinah, and two aspects to this message. First of all, in verse 6, it's the word. Then I heard one speaking to me from the house while a man was standing beside me. So the speaker speaks out of the temple itself. So this is the voice of the Shekinah glory, according to verse 4. This is the Shekinah glory speaking. God himself speaking. He says, a man stood beside me. This is the angel who's been leading Ezekiel around, measuring the temple and measuring the compound. So what's the message from the Shekinah glory? It begins with a declaration in verse 7. He said to me, excuse me, son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet. So he talks specifically to Ezekiel, and he authenticates the millennial temple by saying, this is the place of my throne. So the Holy of Holies is going to be the throne room of Israel's king. This will be the throne room of the king of the world, the king of kings. And this is why the temple will be the most important building on planet Earth, because it will be the capital of the planet, the spiritual, economic, and social and political capital of the world. It will all be here in Israel, in the millennial Jerusalem, on the millennial Mount Zion. The Shekinah also says, this is the place for the soles of my feet. And there's 2 points really here. Number one, the first point is that God is sojourning with Israel. He's dwelling in a close, intimate, personal relationship with the Jewish people. And the temple is also God's footstool, which emphasizes his magnificence, his sovereignty, and his dominion. Now, here is a relief of an Assyrian king. And you see the Assyrian king is sitting on a throne that's high. It's lifted up there. It's on pedestals. That's so he'll be higher than anyone who comes up to talk with him. He'll tower over them. And the only way he can do that is because his throne has a footstool. Footstool's an integral part of the throne. And so that footstool helps emphasize his magnificence, his sovereignty, and his dominion. Well, that's the idea of a footstool. Footstools are used most symbolically in the Bible to refer to God's supreme authority over his creation. The footstool is used especially to refer to his final victory over all those who oppose him. So let's see how footstools are used symbolically in the Bible. God's footstool can be a symbol of the ark and the temple. And there's some cross references there for you. You can just put your video on pause and copy down those cross references if you're interested in referring to them. But God's footstool can be a symbol for the ark and for the temple. God's footstool as a symbol for the earth in Isaiah 66:1. And the point there is that God cannot be confined to any man-made temple. And there's some cross references. Defeated enemies can be regarded as a footstool. And Yeshua will make all God's enemies his footstool, Hebrews 1:13, affirming his supremacy over all any of God's enemies as well as all of the angels. He is supreme in the book of Hebrews. And Yeshua will complete his victory when he returns. And we have the privilege of worshiping God at his footstool even today. Psalm 99:5. Exalt the Lord our God and worship at his footstool. Holy is he. See, the earth can be considered his footstool. So can the Ark of the Covenant be considered his footstool. That's the most humble place of his glory. Because from the footstool, his glory expands up and about, and it's much greater than just the soles of his feet. A person's feet were considered the least important part of the body. And so that's why slaves had to wash people's feet. They were the most dishonorable part of the body. Well, God's feet, that's the lowest part of his glory. And we have to bow down in humility before that. A lot of human beings don't like that idea. We want to be God, but no, God says, humbly worship me at my footstool. And when we look up from his footstool, we see that his glory towers above us. Psalm 132:7. Let us go into his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. So that's what we should humbly do even today. All right, second part of verse 7. God says, God's footstool is where I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever. And there's a couple important words there. First important word is the word dwell. In the Hebrew, that's the word shachan. Means to dwell, to live among, to inhabit, to abide, to stay, to remain, to camp. In other words, to live or reside in a place, usually for a relatively long amount of time. So God is going to live among Israel for a relatively long amount of time. And that amount of time is revealed in the word forever. Now that word is olam. Now you can't just assign one translation to olam. It has a broad range of meaning. You have to translate and interpret olam according to the context in which the word is being used. So first of all, olam, in the context of God and his character, and when it's used with other words of time, can mean everlasting, forever, and eternity. And so it's quite proper to translate it in that manner, in that context. Secondly, olam can refer to something that's ancient or old, something that existed for a long time in the relative past. So you can interpret it that way, according to that kind of a context. Or it can mean lasting. It can mean for a duration of time. That is, an undetermined duration of time, but nevertheless may have limits. May have limits. Well, our context here is the Messianic Kingdom and the God's footstool, the Messianic Temple. So here we know what the time frame is. It's 1,000 years. The Messianic Kingdom and the Messianic Temple will last 1,000 years. So how do we know that? So it'd be better to translate that. This is where I will dwell among the sons of Israel for the length of the kingdom. Might be better to paraphrase that word for just say for 1,000 years. Now, how do I know it's going to be 1,000 years? Well, one of the sources of that information is Revelation 20, verse 6. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Messiah, and what? They will reign with him for 1,000 years. That's the time frame of the Messianic Kingdom. So God will shachan, he'll dwell with Israel for 1,000 years in his temple. Now, this comment is also in answer to the Solomonic prayer of 1 Kings 8, 12-13. Solomon's praying, and Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in a thick cloud. I surely built you a lofty house, a place of your dwelling forever." And so this would be fulfill this prayer. God will dwell with Israel in the temple for 1,000 years. Now, at the end of the 1,000 years, God will never have to abandon his house to judgment again. And we pick this up in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9. When the 1,000 years are completed, that's the time frame of the Messianic Kingdom, that's the length of time in which the Messianic Temple exists. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and gather them together for war. So there will be a rebellion against God and against Yeshua at the end of the Messianic Kingdom. The number of the rebels, the number of them, is like the sand of the seashore, and they will come up on the broad plain of the earth and surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city. So after 1,000 years of absolute perfect environment and seeing the Shekinah glory and having a close relationship with God and knowing God, there's many people that will still not accept Yeshua as Savior, and they won't place their faith in God. And they will be the rebels here at the end of the 1,000 years. And so since there's no excuse, they can't blame anything on God, because the environment is perfect, the government is perfect, the relationships are perfect. And so God will have no patience with them. And what does he do? He just snaps his fingers, and the fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And that's the end of it. God does not have to abandon his house to judgment again. He simply judges those who come against his house. And then we move into the eternal state. And then that's previewed in 2 Peter 3:10-13. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away. That's the tribulation period. The day of the Lord is the tribulation period. The heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. So after the 1,000 years, we have this dramatic change in heaven and earth. And since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? That's an application to all of us today. Looking for and hastening the coming what? The day of God. That's the eternal state, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat. We'll get rid of the old heavens. But according to his promise, we're looking for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So now we move into the eternal state after the Messianic Kingdom is completed. And we get a glimpse of that eternal state in Revelation 21. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain. Now this is not a millennial Mount Zion. This is the eternal mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. And again, it's not millennial Jerusalem. This is the eternal Jerusalem coming down from heaven, out of heaven from God. And the eternal Jerusalem is described there. And we jump down to verse 22. I saw no temple in the eternal Jerusalem. No temple. For the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. So there's no need for a temple in the eternal state. So that's kind of the chronological course of events that relate to the Messianic temple, the length of time that the Messianic temple will be in existence. But the result is that the house of Israel will no more defile my holy name. Starting in verse 7 again. And the house of Israel will not again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their harlotry and by the corpses of their kings when they die, by setting their threshold by my threshold and their doorpost beside my doorpost, with only the wall between me and them. So God is it will finally be free of defilement. The temple will finally be free of defilement. And those who have been guilty of defilement in the past have been the people, the common people, and the kings, the rulers. And the two means of incurring their guilt is by their whoredoms. That's spiritual harlotry, idolatry by the common people, Ezekiel 8. And then by the dead bodies of their kings in their high places. This is the rulers. See, some of the kings of Israel were buried on the grounds of the palace in close proximity to the temple. For example, 2 Kings 21:18. And Manasseh, this is King Manasseh, slept with his fathers and was buried in the garden of his own house in the garden of Uzzah. And Amon, his son, became king in his place. And then we move on to verse 26, now he, this is King Amon, was buried in his grave in the garden of Uzzah, and Josiah, his son, became king in his place. So this location that they're talking about would be on the southeast hill of the city of David where the temple was located, the Solomonic Temple. And in this way, the Solomonic Temple was defiled by corpse uncleanness. Now we get a glimpse of corpse uncleanness in Numbers 5:2. Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. See, God is not associated with death. He's associated with life. And so someone who was suffering from corpse uncleanness had to be sent away from the camp until he could be cleansed. And this is why the Muslims put that graveyard in front of the Golden Gate. And because they would say that the Messiah of Israel wouldn't want to suffer corpse uncleanness by walking through that gate. Well, that's the whole idea here. There had to be a certain distance between corpse uncleanness and the Holy One of Israel. But the palace and the temple stood in close proximity to each other. Their threshold on my threshold, their doorpost on my doorpost. Now, Jewish tradition states that the Solomonic Palace was so constructed that one side was virtually enclosed by the south wall of the temple court. So this is kind of like a duplex. With a duplex, you have one wall and you have a apartment on either side. Well, this was two walls, but the distance between the two walls was too close, too minute. So the Garden of Uzzah and the burial place of these kings was too close to the temple, and therefore defile the temple. So that's the king's sin. They knew better, and yet they buried themselves too close to the temple. Well, the product of this idolatry and disobedience comes out in verse 8. And they have defiled my holy name by their abominations which they have committed, so I have consumed them in my anger. So the product of idolatry and disobedience to the Mosaic laws of purity bring on judgment. One of the many reasons for God's judgment on Jerusalem and the temple in 586 BC. But then we see the heart of God as we come to verse 9, and God's loving counsel is brought forward with an admonition. He says, now let them put away their harlotry and the corpses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell among them forever. in essence, repent. Repent of disobedience. He's talking to the people in Ezekiel's day. And specifically, to the refugees that are in Babylon. He says, change your mind, change your ways. Again, that's in 586. Why? Because the kingdom is coming. Keep your eye on the kingdom. Hebrews 12:28 puts it another way. For us today, he says, and the writer of Hebrews writes, therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken in the future, this is the eternal state, since we're going to receive an eternal kingdom in the future, what should we do today? Let us show gratitude today, by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. That's how we show gratitude to God, placing our trust in Him and performing acceptable service, a righteous lifestyle, with reverence and awe. So the same principle applies to us. You know, live for the coming kingdom. Live with the coming eternal state, eternal kingdom in your heart, in your heart. Well, then he makes a commission to Ezekiel the prophet, and the commission starts in verse 10. As for you, son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. So, very specifically given to Ezekiel, an admonition, number one, two aspects of the admonition. Number one, show the temple, show the house to the house of Israel. Okay, show them the millennial temple. And then tell Israel all of the details of the millennial temple and the millennial Jerusalem, all that we're going to see here. Why? What's the purpose of giving out all these details that seem so irrelevant? I'm sure you've been wondering about that yourself. What's the purpose? That they may be ashamed of all their iniquities. He wants to generate shame over sin. He wants Israel to face the truth about their behavior and their attitudes. The point, in light of the ideal kingdom in the future, now is the time to be spiritually prepared. Get prepared now not only for the Messianic kingdom, but for the eternal state. And again, this is Hebrews 12:28. Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken in the future, let us show gratitude today by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. That's how we show gratitude, serving God with reverence and awe, trusting Him. And, you know, this is one of the reasons for prophecy. This is why God gives us prophecy. This is one of many reasons. But one reason is motivation to live righteously now. Prophecy is to motivate us to live righteous lives. So the lesson, pay close attention to all the minute details and exact measurements that I've given you. In other words, meditate on the future. The minute details and exact measurements speak of the literal nature of the Messianic kingdom to come. And so you see, I teach a literal Messianic kingdom. I don't teach amillennialism. What is amillennialism? Well, let me define it for you. Amillennialism is the theological position that there will be no 1,000-year earthly reign of Messiah after His second coming. No kingdom. No kingdom. Well, what's all this stuff that I've been reading and teaching to you in the book of Ezekiel? I'll answer that in just a second here. It suggests that references to a millennium for the period between Christ's ascension and second coming are figurative. And this is the way an amillennialist gets around all that we've been studying in the book of Ezekiel and then the book of Revelation and other things. It's all figurative. It's not literal. It just symbolizes something else. Well, that totally strips. First of all, that's not the plain meaning of the text. And secondly, that strips the text of any power because you don't know what the symbols are. What do all the little minute details symbolize? I mean, we're supposed to look at all those details. What does a 6-cubit stand for? What does a doorpost stand for? You know, what do all these details stand for? Why is this 5 cubits long and that's 6 cubits long and that's 4 cubits long? See, it totally strips. You don't have to think about that if you make it all figurative. Ah, it's just symbolic of something. Well, it tells us all these little details are there to ensure us, to assure us that the coming Messianic kingdom is a literal, concrete kingdom. That there's a temple there that we will walk into, that we will touch, that we will feel, that we will see, that we will experience. This is not figurative stuff. That makes a lot more sense when you consider all the details, minute details, and exact descriptions we've been given. All right, well, let's move on. That's my rant for the class. Let's move on to verse 11. And Ezekiel is told what to do if Israel responds. If they are ashamed of all that they have done, if this has generated shame in their lives, make known to them the design of the house, its structure, its exits, its entrances, all its designs, all its statutes, all its laws, and write it in their sight so that they may observe the whole design and all its statutes and do them. See, this is literal stuff. We're to ponder this. We're to meditate on this and prepare ourselves to live righteously. So the right attitude that the Jewish community in exile and those that were left in the land, the right attitude is shame for their present condition of idolatry and disobedience. So if they are ashamed, Ezekiel, then make known to them the details of chapters 40 through 48. The details. Don't just wash over it and say it's all figurative. Let them know the details. And the means of providing the details that you and I have been studying in the last few weeks, record it in writing. Record it in writing. And Ezekiel did. He obeyed. That's what he did. That's why he wrote chapters 40 through 48. The exilic community in Babylon and those who were still in Israel must have felt shame because Ezekiel did write out chapters 40 through 48. That's why we're studying him today, thousands of years later. And the purpose for doing this is so that Israel can start obeying now. Not then, but now, today. Israel was to start living in 586 BC in light of the coming kingdom. And again, Hebrews 12:28, folks. Therefore, since we, that's us, you and me, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, the millennial kingdom's coming, the eternal state's coming, let us show gratitude today. We ought to be thrilled that that's the promise ahead of us. How? By which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. That's how we show gratitude to God. You see, God is trying to motivate us to keep our eyes on the kingdom. I thought this was a nice little illustration of the glory of the sun overwhelming this woman here in the field. But we need to be like her, only instead of the glory of the sun, we're looking at the Shekinah glory rising in the east. The eternal promise that we have. This is trying to motivate us to live with our eyes on the kingdom. All right, let's move on to verse 12 and the law of the house. This is the law of the house. Its entire area on the top of the mountain all around shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. So this is going to encompass chapters 40 through 48. And all those chapters, including the chapters 40 through 43, refers to the millennial kingdom and specifically here to the top of the mountain. And this is millennial Mount Zion, the millennial mountain of the Lord's house. He says, the whole temple round about shall be most holy. The whole compound will be holy as the Holy of Holies in the temple proper. So here's Ezekiel's temple, and this is the Holy of Holies, the holiest spot in the temple. But God says it will not be limited to just that location. The whole temple will be most holy, and the entire holy domain will be most holy as well. All of this will be most holy, And here, as we back off to Millennial Mount Zion, we'll learn more about Millennial Mount Zion in a few lessons. There is the Holy of Holies spot on the top of Millennial Mount Zion. That's the holiest place in the world, that 1 square mile during the Messianic Kingdom. Well, then he concludes this with, behold, this is the law of the house, of the temple. Okay, how can we apply this to our lives today? How can this make sense to our lives today? Well, I'd like to close by sharing some meditation points to ponder. And these meditation points come from Ezekiel 40, verse 1 through Ezekiel 43, verse 12. And I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to tell you what application applies to you. I'm just going to share some points here. And if one of these points, you know, touches your heart, then respond to it. Respond positively and make it part of your life. So I'm not trying to meddle in your life, but I'm trying to get us to think about these chapters. How can they mean? What can they mean to me today? And how can they prepare me to live in light of the coming kingdom? All right. So let's take a look at some points to think about. Organization and symmetry. We saw that the temple was incredibly organized. God had it all dressed right and covered down 40 inches all around. You know, all organized and all symmetrical. It wasn't haphazard. It wasn't tossed together. Well thought out. Very, very understandable. Secondly, the idea of obedience was very prominent. You know, Ezekiel had to obey. Israel has to obey. You know, we have to obey. Are we willing to order our lives around the idea of obedience? Are we willing to organize our lives around the idea of symmetry and organization? Or do we just have haphazard lives? You know, God is a God of order. Thirdly, again, orderliness and precision. He knew exactly where everything should go and exactly how big things should be. You know, God knew all the details there. Do we treat our lives casually? You know, imprecise, let it go, we'll see what happens later, you know, who cares? Do we just take a lackadaisical attitude toward our lives? Or do we incorporate the ideas of orderliness and precision in our lives? Imitating God. We looked at the heavenly temple. Now, are we living for that in the future? Are we worshiping God? We'll be worshiping him in the millennial temple. The heavenly temple is God and himself, God the Father and God the Son. Pretty amazing thought there. That'll be a brand new experience in the eternal state. What will that be like? Well, let's meditate about that and think about that. The idea of beauty and decoration is part of the temple as well. God doesn't ignore that aspect. He loves beauty and decoration. He had the palm trees and the cherubim and the wood lining of the Holy of Holies. As you look at the tabernacle and temple, you see skillfully done weavings, you see gold, you see all kinds of beautiful items. So beauty and decoration shouldn't be ignored. We shouldn't go overboard with it, you know, but we shouldn't ignore it either. And of course, that's up to each one of us to decide the extent of emphasis we put on beauty and decoration in our lives. But our churches can have stained glass windows. Maybe yours doesn't. Maybe yours does. You know, things like that. But that's probably a lot better than solid gray concrete walls. No decoration at all. So anyway, let's incorporate a balanced view of beauty and decoration into our lives. How about design, the form and function of our lives? Do our lives function well in the society in which we live? Remember, there'll be open access to the Holy of Holies. At least I believe there'll be open access to the Holy of Holies. And we can come through prayer today, through that incense altar, through prayer, right into our Yeshua's presence, right into the Father's presence. He opened up the way through his sacrifice. He tore the veil in two. So we have open access to the Holy of Holies. So let's go in there as often as we can with prayer. Pray without ceasing. attention to detail. God paid attention to detail. There's a lot of little measurements there that, you know, something was a span wide, something was, a certain number of cubits wide or long or whatever. There was detail in all of the temple here. And we pay attention to the details of our lives, the financial details of our lives, the social details of our lives, you know, the family details of our lives, the business details of our lives, the worship details of our lives. Do we pay attention to detail? Or are we sloppy? You know, it gets back to being organized and careful and responsible with our lives. Holiness. God said the whole area is going to be like the Holy of Holies. And we are admonished to live holy lives, lives that line up with God's standards of behavior. Are we willing to do that? Are we willing to live holy lives in the face of an unholy and dark world in which we live? Well, God calls us to that challenge. The incense altar. Again, incense speaks of prayer. It's a symbol of prayer in Scripture. Do we come to God in prayer? Often, do we pray without ceasing? As the priest burned the incense on the altar, that sweet-smelling smoke would rise and fill the holy place and then penetrate into the Holy of Holies. And he says, and the psalmist says, may my prayer be like the morning offering, like the evening offering, you know. So let's avail ourselves of the great privilege we have of prayer at our personal incense altar every day with God. And then sacrificial altar. Never forget that all these privileges, all that we will be blessed with in the future, the millennial kingdom, the eternal state, all of it comes from Yeshua's sacrifice on our behalf. He loves us so much that he was willing to sacrifice and suffer for us so that he could give us, his children, all of this beauty and glory. And there'll be no more strife, there'll be no more tears, there'll be no more sorrow in the eternal state. You know, we should praise God and thank him. Praise Yeshua and thank him that he was willing to go through sacrifice, go through the cross for us. Wonderful thought. Then there's the throne room. That's where the King of Kings will be. Is he our King of Kings? Is he our Lord of Lords? Do we humbly worship at his footstool, joyfully obeying him? Because we know that he has everything in mind for us that's best and good and holy and right. That's what we're built for, folks. We're built for theocracy. We're not built for democracy. We're not built for republicanism. We're not built for monarchy. We're not built for any other type of government but theocracy, a government by a righteous and holy and just and loving king. That's where our hearts will be satisfied, and all the political turmoil will be gone when we finally live under the type of political system that we're built for, which is theocracy, our loving king. Well, I'm sure there's other points of meditation you could think about too as far as applications here to this section on the tabernacle. So I see I've got less than 2 minutes left. So we'll pick it up. We'll pick it up next session. Let me go ahead and shut that down. There we go. We'll pick it up next session by focusing on the altar of sacrifice that's going to be in the temple. I think you'll find this a meaningful and encouraging and enlightening study as we move into chapter 43, verses 13 through 27, the altar of sacrifice. All right, thanks so much for being our students. We're so glad you come and join us in these classes. We'll see you next session. Lehitra Oat. I heat throat.